welcome back. That phone number again to get Ingo Swann's book is 888-453-4046. This is a must one. Do get this book. 888-453-4046. Operator standing by right now. What's the price, Ingo?
Unfortunately, I'm getting into self-publishing, it has to be $18.95 plus shipping and handling.
I know that.
And it's 219 pages.
Yeah. And we're giving you just a thumbnail sketch of some of the events in the book. Believe me, it is it's remarkable. biomindsuperpowers.com is the website.
Actually, you can get the book through the website, too. There's a click here someplace.
Mm-hmm.
Get right to the order fulfillment house.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You mentioned something last hour that was interesting. We talked about validation being essential to remote viewing. Without validation, what do you have?
Feedback.
That's right. You said some have forgotten about that.
Well, remote viewing was designed always on the principle that feedback would be available somehow, some way, at some point, you know. And when you seize upon the term remote viewing to remote view things where there's never, ever going to be any feedback.
What is it?
You don't know, you know. It's just, it falls into the category of, there's a scientific term for it. You can't disprove it and you can't prove it either way. And, I mean, that's fine for, I guess, fun and games. It's quite conceivable that some information is being gotten. But if you're interested in practical applications of remote viewing, there's no feedback, so you don't know what you've got. And, actually, Dr. Schmeiler and Dr. Osis and Dr. Janet Mitchell and I sort of got the term remote viewing up to describe a kind of experiment where there was feedback using sites that were some distance away. So it was always conceived as a feedback experiment. And that was the glamour of it. I mean, early people, the media even recognized the importance of feedback. So now remote viewing's gone into the English language, and it's being used as it's just being used everywhere without the feedback context.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to move ahead in this narrative a little bit. Then we're going to get to again a particularly remarkable section. There was an event in Los Angeles. In fact, that's the chapter title of chapter 7. The event in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I wanted to call it. I actually had the event in La La Land.
Well, we don't want to offend anyone in Southern Cal now.
Well, I mean, Los Angelinos call it La La Land.
Yeah, they do. They call it other things, too. This is wild. The twins again, and this time they're playing Men in Black.
You want me to...
Oh, please.
Brief this little thing?
Yeah, just a little sketch of it.
I was in Los Angeles doing some developmental work, and I was staying with a friend, and I wanted to have Dr. Shafiga Kargula and her co-worker over to dinner because she was a renowned scientist in perceptions, but she was also an expert in conspiracies. And I figured that I had to get her over to my friend's house so we could ply them with liquor, so she'd tell me everything that she knew about conspiracies. So they accepted, and we had to go to this big supermarket to buy food, and I had prepared a special menu and everything like this, and my friend went one way to get the meats, and I went over to get, I wanted to have stuffed artichokes. So I went into the vegetable place, and in California, this is always a big section of a supermarket.
You bet.
And I finally found the artichokes, and there was this woman examining these artichokes, which had maybe 3 square inches of clothing on her, is what it sort of amounted to, and she was gorgeous, you know, dark glasses and big high heels and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just sort of sidled up to almost next to her and was going to examine these artichokes and other things that were in the periphery of my vision, you know.
Yes, well said, Nino, yes.
And I got this strangest feeling, you know, all of my hairs on my arms stood up and things like this, and I was trying to deal with this, and it just dawned on me that this woman was an extraterrestrial. And I was thinking of this, and I sort of looked, my eye got a little past her, and who's standing down by some orange crates or something like that, I don't know, but what are these twins dressed in black, you know? And I was so scared, I didn't know what to do, because they were watching her. He was watching her, and I thought, I think I shouldn't be here. And so I turned to leave, and as I turned, I saw the other twin at the other end of this vegetable market thing. And I was one confused hombre by that time. So I skedaddled and went and hid in the bread department. And then my friend came, and we did the other shopping, and we went out and got in the car, and he had this little convertible car. And again, I said, wait a minute here. I want you to see this gal is coming out. Is it going to come out here in a minute? So we waited, and she came out pushing her cart full of some guy was pushing it. I don't know. I said, what do you think of that gal over there? And my friend looked at her, and she said, oh, that's just an extraterrestrial. There's lots of them in Los Angeles. And my anchor points, my reality factors absolutely bit the pavement about that point.
Very funny.
And anyhow,
did you have a real sense that this woman was, in fact, not one
of
us?
I did, yes.
I mean, no, you just knew it. I mean, that was
I just knew it. You know, if you're psychic, you know things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I would have been prepared to doubt that completely, of course. You know, go home and throw this dinner party and get drunk and forget about it.
Uh-huh.
Except for these two guys were there. And I says, holy, I'm not supposed to use that word. So.
Yeah, holy fertilizer.
Holy fertilizer. And I'm not sure the dinner turned out really well, but...
you had to be just shaken.
I shake right now when I think of this, because, you know, the body and the mind has memories, and it was so unnerving.
Did the twins exhibit any eye contact with you? Did they?
Yes.
Everybody
had dark glasses on. You know, they wear dark glasses in La La Land. And but I could see them looking at me, and they were just saying, "What's the holy fertilizer are you doing here?" And
now this can't have been simple coincidence.
No, this was not coincidence.
So what are we to think here? The three of them were together to see how you'd react, or something like that. Do you have
they
any?
They could have known I was going to go to this grocery store.
Hmm.
No, we decided this all on the spur of the moment.
All right.
And took off to get this food, you know.
I got that.
Actually, my friend was heading toward another store, and I said, well, you know, we really need good meat. So he turned and went to this big one. It's the big one. It's still there, I think, in Hollywood. You know? And other people, experts, have said this was sort of rigged or something like that and everything, but I don't see how that can be. Because it took place too fast.
Wow.
Anyhow, she was an extraterrestrial.
Probably still is.
And a hybrid, I don't know.
Were you going to say hybrid?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what it was, but she was extraterrestrial.
She's from the planet 10.
I don't know where she was from.
she looked pretty good, right?
Huh?
She looked pretty good.
Oh, she looked wonderful.
That's what I mean by the planet 10.
I mean, what planet is this?
Planet 10. You know, when a girl is good-looking, you give her a 10, Ingo?
Oh.
On the scale of 10?
Oh, on a scale of 10. Oh, no, I think 100.
I
mean, we're going to get above a 10 here. I mean,
off the charts, folks.
This was something, you know.
Yes, ooh, all right, ooh. That sums it up. A strange one indeed in Los Angeles, encounter. You fled back to New York with something you'll never forget. Have you ever seen any woman like that since, another woman anywhere?
No.
Even in the movies?
No.
Have you ever tried to paint her?
Well, it would look really, I mean, you know, there's a couple artists who do these kind of paintings, you know, with this big here and big there, and, you know, very little clothes and everything. That's what it would be look like. It's a feeling that you can't get into that kind of painting.
Mm.
The feeling the feeling was, it was what it was, you know.
Did she look at you while she was thumbing through the artichokes? No.
No. No, in fact, that way, I knew I was going to hear from Mr. Axelrod, and I did in a very strange way, but we won't go into that. That's in the book. The way this now developed from this point on really did impress me about the facilities that this guys had at their disposal. This was incredible. You know?
And this is, again, 25 years ago.
Yes.
We talk at great length on this program about how the technology accessible and available to these deep black programs is so far beyond
to go see that movie. What is it? It slipped my mind now.
Enemy of the State?
Enemy of the State.
Mm-hmm.
That's the state of the art in 1985 as far as I knew back then, but in the 70s they had it too. If you want me to continue, or do you want to continue?
Well, we can go on up to the next level here, and we have to do the event in the Great Northwest. That's, we got to do that.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Yeah, that's an amazing one, unforgettable.
By the way, your background music is wonderful.
Philip Glass.
That Glass?
That's Glass. CD.
Really?
Yeah, the CD is entitled Mishima, M-I-S-H-I-M-A, and we'll be right back. All right, the next events in the book are among, again, they're unforgettable, they're remarkable. Among the most vivid I've read in a long time. A couple of pages in here just rivet the mind. The chapter is called Seeing One, and take us to that if you can, Ingo. I'm going to read a little bit of your description.
Well, we have to show where the telepathy aspect entered in here.
Sure.
I got back to New York. I did talk about this with Mr. Axelrod.
How did you get in touch with him?
Oh, you have to read this. This is so complicated and amazing. I mean, it's so amazing. It's embarrassing to talk about it even. I can write it down and not have to face people. But
so people listening might wonder how you dialed this guy up. He's
No. I don't know. I got messages to go to Grand Central Station and led to a phone booth and blah, 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 and so forth and so on. And he was really concerned, Mr. Axelrod, if this woman had looked at me or had known that I was there. And did she have any telepathic contact with me? And you know, this is when I began to put this whole issue together that, you know, he'd been so cagey earlier on about his interest in telepathy, and now he was frantic, you know, and worried about me, that the implication was that she could have telepathed me into ozone if she wanted to or something like that, you know. And, I didn't fall off the watermelon truck yesterday, and I said, that dirty dog has been interested in telepathy all along, and it means that they know this stuff on the moon. And the real problem is telepathy of these whatever they are. And that's when the telepathy angle came.
Hence the name of the book, Penetration.
Yes, yes, Penetration by telepathy or remote viewing or whatever. Anyhow, I'm breathless.
These guys, Axelrod and the twins, representing obviously a layer that is impenetrably deep in our government, no paper trail, no nothing. And you were aware at that point that they were, I guess, I don't know if I should use the word scared.
I was aware at that point that they had a problem.
They had a problem. They were damn concerned about something, if not outright afraid.
Yep.
And that turns out to be, there's nowhere to run, nowhere to hide.
Yeah, it turned out, in my estimation, through the years, I've had a lot of time to think this through and to do my background work on telepathy and things like that, and their problem was telepathy. No secret.
And remain so to this day.
I think so, yeah.
So, Mr. Axelrod prevailed upon you one more time to do something by way of an offer.
Yeah.
Would you like to see one? And you said,
At this point, why not?
In the 90s, they would just say D-U-H.
What does that mean?
Duh.
Okay.
That's how people have evolved to this this time. They wouldn't say yes, thank you, or wow. They just say duh.
When he said it, I thought I was going to be taken to some, you know, captured UFO that had crashed on Earth or something.
Right, or wreckage or something, yeah.
Something like that, you know. I mean, so that seemed sensible enough anyway.
How did you feel when he said that? I mean, what emotions went through you? Do you remember? You were going to get to see something that few people ever do.
Well, I mean...
Did you suspect there was more to it than just taking Ingo for a nice sightseeing tour?
These whole 20 years, beginning in 1970 up through 1988 and 89, so much that was so out of the ordinary went on, you know, that in a certain sense, this was what I did every day for a living. plus all of the many trials and experiments and things like that, you know, but this was going on in various ways all the time, you know. So just to go see a captured UFO or something like that, mm-hmm. It didn't seem, I mean, everybody thought that they were existing someplace.
So this comes on the heels of you having seen an E.T.
Well, I can't put the whole story together even to this day, you know. I mean... I finally told Axelrod to get lost because I didn't think that my brain could take much more after this.
Well, I'm with you on that.
It did not turn out to be a wrecked UFO, no.
No, it was wilder than that. Again, taken to...
This occurred at SRI. It started there and got in a thing and went out to the airport and got in a private plane.
Like a Learjet kind of a thing.
Yeah, but just a bit more than that. You know, I had been in Learjets already, and this one was more bigger. But it was like that, you know.
And accompanied by, ladies and gentlemen... There they are, the twins.
The twins.
And guess what the twins are doing this time? They're flying the aircraft.
Were they?
Yes. You read the book. It's in there.
I got that in a way. I mean, because when I think of that whole sequence, it goes to the thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they piloted the plane. You were with Mr. Axelrod, and you were in the plane about, you figured, 5 hours. And I think he told you you were going to be driving from that point on for a couple of hours. You didn't know where you were going, but when you got there, you landed in pitch black night conditions. No lights out the windows, no lights on the ground, in a jet landing somewhere in pitch blackness. Now, how did they do that, Ingo, in 1970?
I have no idea. I don't know how any of this happened, just to be honest with you. I don't know.
So you got there. They landed. The twins landed you safely. You got out of the plane, got into a vehicle, drove, and then got out of the vehicle. And I guess you were told you were going to walk for about 40 minutes. And we're going to pause and let our listeners think about that. And what do you see where we're going with this one, folks, in just a couple minutes? The number again for Ingo's book, 888-453-4046. 888-453-4046, the book Penetration by Ingo Swann.
It was a peaceful Colorado camping trip until Dale Musser
awoke to find my tent completely filled with blue light. And my very first thought was, they're back.
Listeners were shocked when Dale Musser told Jeff Rentz the stories of his lifelong encounters with aliens. But most frightening were the actual abductions themselves.
I could hear a sound on the outside of the tent, like something was brushing up against the tent. And I can see these hand-like impressions pushing against the cloth of my tent. And I'm plodding at the wall of the tent trying to get it to go away.
Now you can relive these incredible stories in a 2-hour cassette recording of this memorable Jeff Rentz program. Have your credit card ready and call 888-456-4340 toll free. You'll also receive the current catalog of hundreds of programs now available. Call 888-456-4340 now.
The fellow who was with me, I hear him screaming from his tent. I was in an absolute state of total terror. And the last thought that I had, I'm staring at the door of my tent and I'm thinking, I hope those little bastards can't find the zipper.
Ask for the Dale Musser tape.
This is the end of side one of the cassette. Please stop the tape, turn the cassette over, and continue with side two.
Now, let's rejoin Jeff and his guest.
Now, all of this travel is happening again at night, pitch black, and after a two-hour drive. Well, so many things in this book, I'm just going past that are fascinating. The vehicle itself, apparently, how do we describe this, Ingo? You're driving along, and the idea, of course, is to be very quiet. You were told you must be quiet, you must not make any noise. And the vehicle you're in didn't make any noise.
I know.
I'm sorry to bring this up, but it's in the book. It's bizarre.
Yes, it's bizarre. Yes.
How can a car not make any noise?
I don't know.
It stopped making noise, and the twins are at the controls of the car, driving it. One of them is.
So somebody has equipment that we don't know about.
They sure do.
You know. Anyhow, I know it sounds completely ridiculous. The whole story sounds completely ridiculous, but there it is.
Well, you're under a 10-year stricture at this time, not to talk about that. 10 years is long past, and you have brought this forward. And again, if you have been with us from the beginning of the program, you understand who Ingo Swann is a bit, and you also understand that only someone like him, I think, would have experiences like this in a book. It's just amazing. Go ahead.
Other people have had experience.
Well, not quite in this. This one got me. Let me read one more. This is the last I'm going to read to everybody, but I want to read this one little two-page segment about what happened when you got to where you're going. I'm not going to give you the whole story, but just some of it. I couldn't see anything at all, save the narrowest, dark, blue-green glimmer of dawn in the east. I whispered back to Axelrod, "What am I supposed to do?" "Just observe. We'll debrief later," he responded. "But it's really important now to observe complete silence from this point on, and do not move unless I tell you to. They detect heat, noise, and motion like mad." So I was silent. There we were, four of us sitting silently like rocks ourselves. But suddenly the two twins gave some kind of hand signal. "It's begun," Axel whispered. "Please, please do not make any noise and do not move unless we tell you to." My eyeballs rolled around trying to perceive what had begun. I couldn't see anything unusual at all, save for what appeared to be some gray fog forming up in the direction of the lake. I thought it was just morning fog coming up. This fog continued forming for about 5 minutes, and suddenly I saw what had begun. For in a moment's eye flicker, the gray fog changed, first into luminous neon blue and then into angry purple. At that point, Axel and one of the twins put a firm hand on each of my shoulders, and it was a good thing they did. A network of purple, red, and yellow lightning bolts shot in all crazy directions through the cloud, and I would have jumped up if not held down. And then there it was, somewhat transparent at first, but in the next second, as if fading up, like the movie term, out of nowhere, there it was, solidly visible over the lake whose reflecting waters I could now clearly see, and it was getting bigger. I don't really know what I expected, but I had assumed that what I would see, if anything, would be something like a flying saucer. No chance of a saucer here, baby, because it was triangular and its top angle sort of inverted in pulses, so that overall it appeared to be diamond-shaped. At that moment, in my astonishment, we could hear a wind coming, and it moved past us like a tangible magnetic field, rustling the pine needles and pine trees all around us so much that some cones and branches fell on us. The two firm hands on my shoulders tightened, warning me not to move in pure physical reaction. At the same time, ruby-red laser-like beams began shooting out from the thing, which incredibly was now growing even more in size, while still stationary in its original position over the lake. One of the twins now talked softly, although the sound of his voice was like thunder to me. Crap, they're enveloping the area. They're going to spot us. I had no time to wonder about what he meant. Indeed, some of the laser beams had begun blasting pine trees, of all things. At the same time, the thing had now increased its size to what may have been about 90 feet wide. The whole of this so far had been accomplished in complete silence, and even the electric bolts had not crackled. The blasting of the trees, though, was now audible, while at the same time I could begin to hear low-frequency pulsations. "They're blasting deer or porcupines or something in the forest," Axel explained softly in a calm but tense stage whisper. "The beams sense biological body heat, and they're sure to hone in on us." At that moment, the two hands tightened on my shoulders, and I was dragged and practically thrown back down the arroyo behind. There was a terrific pop where we had just been, and some large branches of nearby pines cascaded down upon us. That was my last sight of the triangular thing, but in that last moment, I could see the water of the lake surging upward, like a waterfall going upward, as if being sucked up into the machine. And we'll stop there. There's much more. It is quite a story, and I think you get the picture.
Like me throwing up in the river not too long after this.
Three times.
Oh, you know, after this book was gone to the printer, I heard about all of the water fairies that have been appearing in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
And just last week, somebody made me a copy of a video that one of the broadcasting systems that prepared that created these scenes again of these. Theirs were round and like stainless steel, but they came and sucked up the water from lakes. And this was, I wish I'd have had this before I got this book printed so I could have put it in.
Well, then the next edition you can.
Yeah.
1-888-453-4046 for the book penetration. It is a page-turner, and we are going to talk about many more things tonight. The moon, what's apparently up there, is a lot more than rocks and dust and craters. And
That's part two of the book.
That's right. And we move into that. And then part three, the issue of telepathy and our visitors or neighbors.
Charles Fort said once, he says, "I think we're property," which takes on some meaning. If you read this in other books, I'm not the only one that, I do provide a bibliography of sources of other people who've done a pretty good job on the inhabited moon type of thing, you know, and
sure.
the cover up about it.
Many people have been able to see things on the moon with basically powerful home telescopes over the years. Celestrons, 600 power, is it? Can do it?
Well,
something like that.
You can see things vaguely. Some has to be a mile big to be seen.
And there are apparently things that big up there moving around. We're going to pause, and your calls are welcome. 1-888 on radio. We've given you a real tease of this book called Penetration by Ingo Swann, and we'll be right back. And there was much more to that incident at a lake up in what apparently was Alaska. And you knew it was Alaska when you drove out of there. You suffered an injury in that, by the way, to your leg, which we mentioned you were bleeding. And the idea apparently is that these craft, whatever they are, neutralize all biologic entities in the immediate vicinity, I guess, so there are no witnesses?
I guess so. That one didn't want to be seen by anybody. So, I mean, you know, overkill of anything that's got infrared vibes, I guess, or something like that.
Yeah. Any evidence that you've come across where humans may have been French fried during ET events?
Well, you don't see it much anymore, but, tabloids like the National Enquirer used to run stories on people who touched flying saucers and got fried and things like
yeah.
that.
You know, the interesting thing about the tabs is that there actually is some important news in them from time to time. They're used to float things, and yeah. It's not all garbage.
No. Men in Black, if you saw that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I did. I don't go to many films, but that was a very enjoyable film, and there certainly were a lot of nuggets in there that were significant. How did you react to that, by the way, now that you brought it up?
Well, I thought it was, you know, I didn't know how they could pull this off, but they pulled it off, and my mouth was hanging out because it became temporarily so real. You know, they suspended the disbelief of the audience and things like that, and you just went with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt very much that the ETs are giant cockroaches.
Mm-hmm.
Even this is real to me. But,
quite a piece of escapism, to be sure, waiting for the sequel, which will no doubt be as big a box office as the first one. By the way, just about movies for a minute or two. You may go to films a lot. You live in New York. I don't know. What other films have you seen that would have more truth than fiction, or at least substantial pieces in them that are worth considering along this vein? Science fiction.
I think Close Encounters of the Third Kind has a reality basis. You know, there's all these rumors in the gossip lines that contact was made. Mm-hmm. With humans at some point and so forth and so on. It's really hard to track down anything that, you know, that is substantial about it. But certainly that, as far as I'm concerned, there's the evidence that there are structures and activities on the moon is really compelling. And the fact that we haven't gone back to it since we apparently were told to stay away back in the 60s.
No, that story has been around there. You tend to give a little bit of credibility to that we were told to stay in your own backyard, don't mess out here.
Yes, yes. Why we didn't go back really is an issue that needs to be examined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the full intent, as I later found out, I mean, I wasn't up on the space race back then, but I got up somewhat up to date, you know.
Uh-huh.
The whole intent was to colonize the moon, to act as a space station for going to other places.
That's right.
That, you know. And that was just dumped.
Real quickly, without ceremony, it just came off the stove, not the back burner, folks, it came off the stove altogether.
And that, you know, that needs to be looked at, you know. I don't know how to have it looked at, but it certainly needs to be looked at.
Ingo, hold that receiver closer to your talking.
I'm sorry.
You're fading a little bit in and out. I don't know if it's the line or the phone. But, yeah, it's very true. It's a very perplexing question. Always bothered me why the whole space program just took its eyes off the moon, basically. Now we've got the
Soviet,
lunar...
The Soviets... too.
Yeah, 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 exactly. Now, there are some people who suggest that, in some cases at least, those Apollo missions did not take place. They were staged, big sound stage, wherever. Some suggest underwater in large tanks to duplicate the moon's gravity. Any instinct on that? Could some of those missions, part of them, perhaps been...
That was a hypothesis in another movie. I think it was called Saturn IX or something like that.
Yeah.
Way back when.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that there was the evidence is just too compelling that there was the Soviets and the United States made a very big and a very expensive effort to get to the moon and colonize it. I mean, I think they did get to the moon. Certainly the Ranger... things that were sent up there to take photographs and before they crashed on the moon were real.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's no reason to think those weren't real. And then they were followed up by the actual men going to the moon.
Mm-hmm. Some suggest that maybe the later missions, they were already in the pipeline, and rather than just scrub them, might have been possibly staged, at least in terms of what the media was disseminating to the public, because that stay away signal might have been issued prior to the end of the actual train of Apollo missions. All spec, of course. Have you RV'd the moon lately, Ingo? Do you still look around up there from time
I'm
to time?
I'm concerned about telepathic contact with an AET. I'm serious, you know. I mean, this is... I now have a background in this which was frightening. And I don't want to do it by myself. I mean,
I think the gist of what you're saying is we may be being interfered with, controlled, manipulated, managed telepathically, read. These people that you worked with 24 years ago were afraid. Do you have any reason to suspect that that fear continues to this day, to that extent? Have things changed any?
Well, if the scenario, I present this just as a scenario. I'm not presenting it as a complete reality. But the scenario needs to be examined. And if those guys had this problem back then, which he did, mm-hmm. Axelrod, I mean, this was a problem. That problem still exists today, to this day. It hasn't been resolved. In fact, it's very suspicious that it's never been talked about, especially when you consider that most of the abductees say that they were communicated with telepathically.
Every time.
And this term, this aspect of the abductees is completely avoided. I mean, nobody makes an issue of that. You know, they just pass over it.
Well, it's more or less accepted as de rigueur. It's the way it's done, telepathic.
Yeah, but nobody examines the telepathic, the implications of this.
Well, that's what you've done in this book called Penetration.
I've tried to.
You have done magnificently. By the way, the dedication of the book, this book is dedicated to Mr. Axelrod, wherever and whoever he is.
Yeah.
Well done. Paul in San Jose would like to... step up here and say something, listening on the internet, real audio. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Jeff.
Hi.
Hi, Indigo. I have a question. By the
Ingo.
Way, I've read...
Ingo.
Sorry, Ingo.
Sorry.
I've read the book, and my question is, after you're preparing the book and getting ready to go to the printer, did you get any inclination about what's going on up there on the moon again?
No. Well, there's been a little diddling around, but this is a sort of a different approach to it all and things like that.
On whose part?
Well, it needs to be gotten together and presented in somewhat of a feasible way.
Just for the record, Paul, as you know, Ingo, the U.S. Navy... sent Clementine up there to literally map the entire moon, which is an interesting thing.
Well, I know that, but the issue involved with Clementine is that it was completely... If you have seen Enemy of the State, you realize the high-resolution photography capability these days.
Yep.
Right, and I'm in Silicon Valley.
Hold on, Paul.
There's no high-resolution photography ever been released from the Clementine mission.
Low res, and that's right. That's very well said. Okay, Paul, one more comment.
I used to live in the mountains up here in Los Gatos, which is just outside of Silicon Valley. And mm-hmm. when I read the book, one of the things I was struck by is the comment about the availability of telescopes larger than 16 inches. And I've actually been considering trying to get some people together and put an array up, because Mount Hamilton is right across from us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it used to be an ideal observation area, and if you move a little bit more towards Santa Cruz, you can still see up there. And I'm wondering, if we do this, is there a good chance we'll observe something? That's why I asked the question.
Well, there's a network of people who are very interested in the occupied moon, and they have used telescopes. But 16 inches isn't going to be high enough resolution to see details smaller than a mile or 3 football fields or something like that. But you can certainly see things like lights and stuff moving in the... You can probably see the clouds, a few things like that.
Yeah, right. People are saying clouds. Yes, clouds we talked about in the book, clouds hanging out along the rims of some of the larger craters.
These are referred to as the anomalies of the moon.
Right. I remember reading about a Japanese researcher which had recorded very large flashes on the moon with, I think, a 14-inch telescope.
Yes. Yeah, right. You can see those because they are not reflected light. They're issuing light. So those you can see those easy with even an 8-inch if it's a good one. But to see details like a football field, you're going to need maybe a 60-inch one, and these are really impossible to come by.
Right. We have so much surplus technology in this particular area. I was considering looking for something like a CCD array or a 20-inch optical array, maybe 20
it.
Inches.
I love it. Go do it. Do it.
Yeah.
Do it. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really love your show, Jeff.
And thank you very much, Paul. I'm glad you read the book. For those of you out there, here's the number again, 888-453-4046. One of the great books of the year. That's 888-453-4046. Things in this book that I have not seen so succinctly stated anywhere else. I'm going to pause and come right back another hour, hour number three with Ingo Swann. Your calls are welcome if you'd like to get on the phone with us here. You just pick it up and dial 1-888 on radio, and we'll probably get you in. We've got lines open right now. That's 888 on radio. Don't forget to visit my website at sightings.com. Thanks to you, we're about 4 million total hits a month now and growing. And we'll pause and see you in about 7 minutes.